Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, in for Jennifer Grossman, Atlas Society CEO. I've been looking forward to this session. We have senior scholar Dr. Richard Salzman discussing, is objectivism a religion? Which there's probably at least three ways to even take that question. We encourage audience participation. So after Richard gives his opening, we'll take questions. If you're new to Clubhouse, you can join by raising your hand with the hand icon. This is being recorded for educational purposes. Richard, thank you for doing this session today. You know, even in promoting it, you know, I had some objectivists say, what kind of question is that? So I really look forward to your answer and even in what sense.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad there are some objectivists out there willing to entertain questions and not be fearful of them. I am curious also, Scott, what your three takes on that might be, so we can get to that. Okay, here's what I'm going to try to do in less than a half an hour, and then open it up, maybe even less than 25 minutes, and then open it up for comments, criticisms, questions. First off, answering the question, but also distinguishing between religion and objectivism. I'm going to have some interesting quotes you might not be aware of from Ayn Rand herself about religion. Turns out she was not a militant atheist, as she called it. She was an atheist, but not a militant one. That's interesting. And some nice things she said about religion, but why? Why would she say nice things about it? That turns out to be very philosophically interesting, I think. And then I'm going to shift. So making that distinction, I'm going to move into, well, why would the outside world think of objectivism as a religion, or sometimes they'll call it a cult? And why would some even self-described objectivists possibly misuse the philosophy and treat it like a religion? And that'll lead us into the third section, which is, what is the difference between open and closed objectivism? And I think Professor Kelly and I have talked about this at great length. And of course, he's originated this aspect of it years ago. So he's very good on that. So he's very, very kindly agreed to chime in on that as well, but also on the religious aspects of it. If I get any of this wrong, all of you feel free to chime in. Now, not to keep anyone in suspense, my answer to the question is no. No, objectivism is not a religion, but this is a really important question because it is seen as such by so many people. And among the conservatives, actually, they'll say, well, it doesn't have enough religion. How do I handle that? Now, let me tell you a kind of a cute story that prompted my thinking of this years ago. A professor and I were talking about objectivism, and I was explaining it, defending it. And this person was a Catholic, a very good professor, actually. And this Catholic professor said to me, but isn't objectivism a religion? And I said, well, before I answer that question, isn't that a compliment by your own standards? If you're religious, then apparently you're complimenting this thing called objectivism because it's a religion and you're not irreligious. And that kind of silenced the person. I don't think they know what to go with that afterwards. Maybe a false religion, something like that. But you'd hear that a lot by religious people saying other things are religious and they're criticizing it, not realizing they're religious. Let me start this way. What is religion? Now, this, again, can be oversimplified. I would put it as a set of, and I don't know if I want to say system, but maybe a system of notions, of beliefs, of surmises. I love that word. If you look up surmise, believing things without evidence, fables, parables. Now, that sounds kind of bad connotation, but let me add to that purport to explain the universe and its origins. That purports to guide life's choices, which sounds like ethics. Psychologically, you could say that intends to mollify anxiety, say, you know, fear of death or what will happen on Judgment Day. Explaining good and evil. Now, it obviously believes in the supernatural, so it is not this earthly, this worldly. It believes in God or gods, plural. Most of them have prophets who are, testifying to their link to, they're either representatives of or interpreters of the God. You know, so for example, the Judeo, Moses is the prophet, Judaism, they got a text, the Talmud, the Jesus is the prophet, and the Christianity of God, they have the Bible, the New Testament, Muhammad, Islam, they got the text, Quran. So the idea of gods, prophets, sacred texts, interpreters, qualified interpreters, meaning some are disqualified, scholastics, if you want to call them that, keepers of the flame. What other aspects? Means of either acceptance or excommunication. Excommunication might be a specifically Christian concept, so don't hold me to that. But the idea of who's in or out of the club, who's in or out of the tribe, are there sects and S-E-C-T-S, sects, schisms? Yes, there are multiple, as you know, multiple with the Protestant Reformation, the breaking up of Christianity into various sects, Catholicism and all that. And so the key, though, how do you know all this stuff? Epistemologically, you got to go by faith, by revelation, by feeling, by intuition, however you want to refer to it. I think that's a fair reading of what religions are, both the good and the bad. But the good here being it does provide an overarching kind of view of the world. And I'm going to quote Ayn Rand on this in a few moments, which is very interesting. Now, what is objectivism? Putting it up against what I just described religions to be. Capital O objectivism, a system of philosophy discovered and explicated by Ayn Rand. I mean, that would be one definition. It doesn't say much other than the author. But this is an author who specifically says, we don't go by appeal to authority. Even though I'm the author, I'm not authoritarian about this. You must use reason. You must reject faith as a means of knowing anything, including objectivism. But now what's interesting about objectivism? Okay, it's a philosophy. It has something to say in the five key branches. But what's distinctive about it? Now, interestingly, she's not the first atheist. There were atheists before Ayn Rand. There were what we may call today secularists. What about individualism? Individualism predates Ayn Rand. She even said one time that Christianity ensconced individualism in the world, and she said, thankfully. What about the concept of rights? I think she is distinctive here, but it's not as if no one thought of rights. The rights of man were a big part of the Enlightenment argument, including, by the way, the proper role of government in protecting those rights. Not even egoism, I would say, although she has a very distinctive conception of egoism. Remember, the subtitle of The Virtue of Selfishness was A New Concept of Egoism. But most of the egoists or advocates of egoism previously were psychological egoism, meaning you are inherently egoistic. You don't have to choose to be so. It's not ethical egoism. So she is very distinctive, first, I would say, in being systematic. That's the most important thing, you know, besides obviously the admonition always go by reason. But the systematic nature of it, the consistency of it, the interconnectedness of the hierarchical structure of the five branches is distinctly Rand. There are very few philosophers who have something to say on all the five branches, and not just something to say, but a lot to say and a lot of interrelation and integration between them. So branches actually may be too inaccurate a term for it. We got trunks, we have roots, we have foundations, we have branches, leaves, implications on things like that. So that definitely distinctive on a theory of concepts, which lead to a theory of principles and propositions and induction and all that. And how do we verify our knowledge? How do we confirm our knowledge? I think her conception of what objectivity consists of, one of the reasons she named her philosophy objectivism, going there to the real central issue at hand, how are we to be objective? I mentioned egoism before, definitely rational self-interest, rational egoism. What's today called ethical egoism, the idea that you're advocating egoism. You're not saying people are naturally egoistic. They might not be. Well, they are not naturally egoistic. They must learn how to be egoists. They must learn how to be long range. They must learn how to be contextual. So that is, I think, distinctive if you know the history of how egoism has been treated. I would say objectivism is also quite distinctive on its treatment of capitalism as a system, as a socio-political system. She said it's more than just economics. I mean, capitalism, the unknown ideal, to her was a moral ideal, but you know, that book is full of history, full of economics, but also moral arguments. And that is distinctively Ayn Rand, the idea that capitalism is to be seen not just as an economic system, but as a moral one. And then further, that morality means rational self-interest. I think the last thing I would name, it's absolutely not the only things that should be on this list, is in aesthetics, romantic realism. So on every, I would say on every score, if you put up those two against each other, you cannot say that objectivism is a religion. Why? Because it's not supernatural. It doesn't rely on faith, and it has a positive view of human nature, if you will. None of this original sin stuff, none of this really unjust denunciations of humans and human nature. And so the question, before I turn to the question of, well, why would someone think it's a religion, or why would someone who gets into it start treating it that way? Well, before I quote Ayn Rand, let me just offer two suggestions to think about. The thing they share in common, which the outsider, so to speak, would see, is absolutism. Absolutism. So versus, say, relativism, versus those out there who say, not just in ethics that, you know, anything goes, but epistemologically that no certainty is possible. They're going to look at objectivism and religion together as absolutist systems. So I think, and to the extent they denounce absolutes, they're going to denounce both and say, wow, that's a religion because you guys are absolutists. You see how that can happen? But the absolutism I see in religion is dogmatic. And the absolutism I see in objectivism has to do with contextual certainty. That's a big issue. That's a huge issue. But I just wanted to put that out there as a plausible reason why someone would think, especially a relativist, that objectivism or religion share this thing called absolutism. I think another phenomenon is, well, most people are raised religious. And so if they become objectivists, or if they get into objectivist material, it's very easy, especially in the early going, to totally misconstrue what the heck is being said. So let me give you an example. I was raised as a Catholic, so I saw this happen among Catholics, but Christians generally maybe experience this. You get the admonition when you're a kid, don't judge, lest ye be judged. Don't judge other people. And now you get into objectivism, and objectivism says, judge everything, absolutely everything. Judge, judge, judge. And of course, if you read deeply, it's judge objectively, judge contextually, judge fairly. But in this interregnum between leaving a system that says don't judge at all, meaning they equip you with no power to judge, no techniques, it's very easy for objectivists to get into what's called moralizing, where they're judging arbitrarily. And they're just learning, and badly, and they might even leave the studying objectivism because it feels uncomfortable to them, and they're losing a lot of friends and potential allies by judging arbitrarily. But see, that to me, that's not objectivism's fault. That's the problem of making this transition from religion to objectivism. So objectivism is a corrective, but it can't necessarily root out everything that's embedded in the religious person. I got to give you this quote now that you'll love this on Ayn Rand on religion from the Tom Snyder interview on TV, 1979, because she comments on religion and objectivism. And I think this is worth quoting. This will take about 3 minutes,
sure,
maybe 4 minutes. Tom Snyder, how does objectivism differ from the philosophies that many of us have been exposed to in our youth? Philosophies based on religions, theologians, dogmatists? Great question, huh? And Ayn Rand's answer. The very first difference, objectivism tells you that it is not right, that it's not proper to man to take anything on faith. Religion is a matter of faith. You accept a religion emotionally or because you were born into it. You have not chosen it rationally. What objectivism tells you is that man's reason is his basic means of survival. That's the most important faculty he has. And he has to guide his life and make his choices by means of his rational faculty. He has to make his own choices, but he has to know how to make them, unquote. Now, a follow-up question, another really great question. Tom Snyder, why do you think religions have attracted so many more people to their philosophies than objectivism has attracted people to its philosophy? And Ayn Rand actually giggled when she got this one. She said, well, first of all, they had a much longer time. Remember, I'm quoting here, religion is older than objectivism. I don't think I'd want to attract as many people as religions do. But the real and serious answer is this. Religion is a primitive form of philosophy. What religion and philosophy have in common is that they're systems of background premises. They give you a frame of reference, a context in fundamental terms. Then you live the concretes of your life accordingly. Religion is primitive, canned philosophy. It gives canned answers and says, here, you can rely on this and you don't need to think. It will tell you what to do in practically every situation. Just obey us, take us on faith. Why do people accept it? Because nobody can live without philosophy. Even the most primitive, unthinking man needs something to tie all of his actions together, his ideas in life. He needs integration. Religion provides to him, ready-made, this integration. But philosophy properly does the same thing but offers a context to his mind and demands of him that he judge it, that he use his own intelligence to understand and accept the kind of basic premises that will guide his life rationally. I think that's very interesting because she's seeing the relationship between religion and philosophy broadly, but then objectivism as a philosophy. She's basically saying this is enlightened way of going at philosophy, using reason, rationality, objectivity, a focus on reality. But notice it isn't a, it's not a condemnation really of religion. It's a description of religion that that is basically saying this is something that's helpful, you know, as opposed to say nihilism. But is it preferable? No, you want a rational reason-based philosophy. But I thought that, and by the way, this is not just in the Tom Snyder interview. I have scoured not just the nonfiction of Rand, but some of the more interesting things on religion and relationship to objectivism is in her letters. So the letters of Ayn Rand, if you go to the index, there are entries on Aquinas. You know she liked Thomas Aquinas very much, a Catholic philosopher. Why? Because he used reason to try to prove the existence of God. And of course, she knows that's not possible, but at least he's got the primacy of reason there. But also entries on God, on Christianity, on Catholicism. There's a couple of letters to ministers, which is interesting. There's a very interesting letter to Goldwater just before the 1960 election, where she's telling him that conservatives ought to be very careful about not mixing the case for capitalism with religion. There, by the way, she says, quote, this is on 567 of the Letters of Rand, the philosophic default of the conservatives will become final if capitalism, the one and only rational way of life, is reduced to the status of a mystic doctrine. I am not suggesting that you should take a stand against religion. I'm saying that capitalism and religion are two separate issues which should not be united into one package deal or one common cause. That does not mean that religious persons cannot crusade for capitalism. I love her use of the word crusade there. But it does mean that non-religious persons like myself cannot crusade for religion. She goes on to remind him that the Constitution requires a separation of church and state. So to sum up where I am so far, religion is one thing, objectivism is another. They're very different, but the thing they do share is they are philosophies. There's no doubt about it. They are a unified, comprehensive attempt to guide people and help them interpret the world. One medieval, the other, I would say, enlightened. Now, a couple of suggestions on why might this go wrong. I already indicated why some people might come to objectivism with a religious background and not quite be able to know how to do the conversion, so to speak. It's a lot of work. I mean, this is philosophy is not automatic. It's not a fatalistic account of this, but it's not easy if someone is raised in a religious setting and then comes to objectivism. But you can see the appeal. They would say, wow, here's another comprehensive philosophic view of the world. I wonder if I should adopt this one. People do convert from one religion to another, after all. So it's still this interest in the comprehensive view, the idea of I want to do the right thing, so let me get the right ethic. Here's another way, however, to go at objectivism philosophically. So this is amounts to misusing objectivism. You come into it and you like the fact that it might be conceived of as a self-contained, limited system put forth by an authoritative figure with a bunch of texts which can be closely examined, and then you become a specialist in it. And then, since it's a very small group to begin with, you become famous within that circle for interpreting the great works. And for lack of a better description, it goes to your head. It's people who now, while I am expert in this thing, and now this thing has to really be circumscribed. Why? Because if it grows and it's bigger, if literally the shelf grows of this work on objectivism, you either have to specialize or you have to be able to hold it all. You can't hold it all. You can't read it all. You might have been able to in 1960 when there were three or four books and as yet no nonfiction work really being written. But you see how this might go, that someone might get into it and start treating it religiously. And they may not even be aware that they're doing it, but that's what they're doing. Now, this leads me to, so this is something like, I don't know, you look at steak knives. What's the purpose of steak knives? To cut steak. But they can also be misused, you know, as weapons.
Any technology.
Or technology generally, or nuclear energy. So that is just as a suggestion. I don't want to go too far with this, but this will lead me now. I got 22 minutes into this. Let me finish with how this might relate to the issue of open versus closed objectivism. In a very restrictive and possibly unfair, but I've heard it, a restrictive definition of closed objectivism would be something like this. Objectivism, since Ayn Rand gave that name in about 1959 or so, by the way, if you look at the Mike Wallace interview, he refers to her as a Randist, and he refers to Randism. And she strenuously objects on national television and says, no, I call my philosophy objectivism. A very interesting choice because she's basically not wanting to make it idiosyncratic. And I think she used a joke or someone did about Marx saying one time, I am no longer a Marxist, having seen what all the subsequent Marxists did to mangle his views. But that's a very interesting conception by Rand to say, I need to give it a proper name, but a name that's not my name. However, the closed objectivism view in its strictest form basically says objectivism is and only is what Ayn Rand wrote and said. That's it. Since she named the philosophy and created it and devised it. Now, by that reading, everything stops in March of 1982. That's it. That's when she died. You can't, by this weird definition, classify anything that came afterward as objectivism. But think of what this includes. Such stupendous works as The Evidence of the Senses, that's 1986. Opar by Peikoff, that's 1991. And I won't go on. There are other books, articles, lectures, appearances, interviews, debates, for good or ill, in quality, subsequent to that. And in cases like Evidence of the Senses or Opar, just the too early entries, no one could say that that is not objectivism. And yet it's not what Ayn Rand wrote. It's not what Ayn Rand said. So really what's happening here is anyone who endorses those as objectivism is moving out of the argument that it's only what Ayn Rand said and only what Ayn Rand wrote. They're willing to concede, in other words, that as long as subsequent work either builds upon Rand interprets RAND, applies RAND to new areas that she hadn't thought of or her followers had not thought of when she was alive, are objectivists. If they follow, now here's the big debate, if they follow and build upon the core precepts of objectivism, the absolutely indispensable elements of objectivism, without which it wouldn't be objectivism. But there are so many things that she said and wrote which could be construed as somewhat extraneous and optional. I would include, by the way, whether women can be presidents or not. You know, Margaret Thatcher was a fabulous prime minister in Britain who actually took office before Ayn Rand died. I have a hard time believing that wouldn't be a better political leader than the others we got in Britain up until then. So maybe others could name others, but I think, as David Kelly put it once, as in court, you want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Absolutely. That's an objective kind of criteria checklist. And the question is, has everything Ayn Rand wrote or said, is that all of it? Is that the whole truth? Well, the argument is, no, it isn't. But that doesn't mean we can adulterate what she left us and change it for our own whims, which some people refer to as open objectivism. I interpret, but I'll leave this mostly to David Kelly. Open objectivism to me is the idea that objectivism, as given to us by Ayn Rand, is the foundation, and it has definite core principles that can be objectively identified, by the way. But much more has to be done. Much more has to be learned. Much more has to be applied. I'm quoting from something David wrote. Ayn Rand, this is from the Atlas Society, 2010, what the Atlas Society stands for. One excerpt says, Ayn Rand laid the foundation of objectivism. It's now the responsibility of those who grasp the brilliance of her achievement to build on that foundation, addressing the many philosophic questions she left unanswered, from the nature of certainty to the ethics of families to the requirements of objective law. Further, objectivism is not a religion, that's still quoting Kelly here, with teachings defined by a sacred text like the Bible or the Quran. Our loyalty is not to Rand's words, but to the truth of her fundamental insights. A commitment to truth and respect for independent thought must lead onward to new questions, new answers. We reject any use of loyalty tests in giving thinkers their due. We acknowledge, respect, and cite good work by all objectivists and reject the closed dogmatic style that has retarded the objectivist movement for 50 years. So that's a lot there in a short time, and I hope it's not too much to take in. I hope there's enough to chew on. That's my thinking on this. I think it's an important question. And I'll leave it there, Scott, for you to adjudicate.
Great. Thank you. That's great stuff. It is a very wide scope. I just wanted to say one thing before throwing it to Atlas Society founder Dr. Kelly, because you quoted what makes objectivism unique, and I don't think you'd read it, but he writes about that in The Contested Legacy of Ayn Rand. I know you weren't reading from it, but there was a lot of overlap, not in a religious way, but just two people understanding the ideas.
Yeah.
And Dr. Kelly, go ahead. I wanted to get your take on this.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. And thank you, Richard. That was great. I just want to add a couple of things. First of all, I think your point about that people from the outside look at objectivism and religion and think they're both absolutists. They both think they have the objective truth and an objective moral standard. And so people say, well, only religion has that, so objectivism must be a religion. I know in my own experience, when I got to know people in my youth, like in graduate school, I began getting to know some of the other graduate students, people would ask me, are you a Catholic? You know, when they didn't know anything more, they just assumed, I had standards.
Yeah.
Only Catholics have standards.
Yeah.
So I had to explain, no, no. Yeah. The other thing I would make, a couple other things. One is, I highly recommend a book that we produced years and years ago, decades ago, by George Walsh, who is my co-founder for the Atlas Society, called The Role of Religion in History. And here's the definition of religion in there that I think is consistent with, but with what you said, Richard, but interesting, and he's tried to condense it to, you know, a formal definition. And then he goes into the book covers all the major world religions. And in that regard, you know, religion is interesting philosophically because by contrast with fundamentalists in every form of religion, there are also people who have tried to apply reason to interpreting the doctrines of the sacred text. This is true both in Judaism, with the Talmud, with Christianity, with mostly inside the Catholic Church, people trying to make a philosophical system out of it, culminating in Thomas Aquinas. And in Islam, some of the great, and there were great philosophers in Islam in the early years, trying to rationalize the interpretation of the Quran. And actually, the Islamic thinkers were clear about the difference between the practice of religion, the theory of religion, theology, and philosophy. And the difference between theology and philosophy was theology is committed to making sense and making a consistent whole out of, from the starting point of a sacred text. And whereas philosophy didn't make that assumption. It just was looking at the world and trying to figure out what is the world like. Now, most of the early philosophers in both fields were in both Christianity and Islam. And I expect this is true also in Judaism, which I know less about, were deep philosophical thinkers like Aquinas. And I think that's what Ayn Rand admired in religion, that there was an intellectual history here of people who, you know, were not just the latest, you know, Zen faddists in California. They were actually deep thinkers who were trying to make sense out of, granted, a canonical text, but also trying to elaborate that into a coherent, logically consistent system, which is the act of reason. And in that respect, it was always theology was always tied to we can't come out against the sacred text. And just one more little incident. Back in 2007, there was the Atlas Society, the Ayn Rand Institute's intellectual support wing approached college in Texas, Texas State San Marcos, and offered them money to fund a new position that would teach objectivism. And there was a debate on it, and people wanted the money. They were okay with someone teaching objectivism. But then one of the members of the department, it was the Department of Religion and Philosophy, did some research and found out that the only people maybe the Anthem Foundation, I forget which, were willing to support were people who were trained at the Ayn Rand Institute. And she said, wait a minute, there's a whole other organization here. And so it was a brouhaha. It made the pages of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And the reporter talked to me. But I talked to the woman, Rebecca, get her last name. And what interested me most was that her doctoral thesis at the University of Chicago had been on how sacred texts become the foundations of philosophies. I thought, oh my God. So there is in some of the back and forth debates about open versus closed objectivism, a lot of religious language. Richard, you on a phone call earlier today, you mentioned the idea of preaching to the choir. That is, speaking only to those who already agree. There's also the concepts of excommunication, apostasy, and so forth that are
heresy.
Invoked heresy. So.
Yeah, and you alluded, David, to the something I neglected to add. This issue of open versus closed, one of it has to do with the text, the authoritative nature of it. When the system closes, if it's closed, it closes at some point, March 82. But also, you quite agree from your own experience, a theory of outreach, who to talk to, who to deal with.
Yes. And who you're the closed allowed system. To talk to.
Yeah, so the closed system, originally David trying to, in, was it 88, 89, David, telling, being asked by libertarians to speak, and David's talk was, why you guys need objectivism? And now why that would be sacrilege is crazy to this day, but it still goes on. There are still denunciations of objectivists who get interviewed by conservatives like Dennis Prager or who go on stage with... I think the other side is basically doing open objectivism. They just don't admit it. And I think, and won't, apologize to someone who figured this out 30 years ago and paid a price for doing it, David. But I think also of, I hear it sometimes put, the open objectivism approach adulterates or allows for the adulteration of what Ayn Rand. With the minute you say there's more to be said, there's more to be elaborated. This is the foundation, and we're building on the foundation. We're not rejecting the foundation. Anyone who builds on a foundation isn't eroding the foundation as they go. The foundation is there. It's solid. You're building on it. But the idea of not building, yes, I think you could say that could retard it for decades on end if that's the approach. And if the approach amounts to not may the best argument win, but rather let's tear down competing organizations that are trying to promote objectivism. But it also strikes me as, once you venture on to this openness, David, there is the possibility of getting it wrong. And it's almost as if someone's saying, since it's possible for you to adulterate, I'm assuming you're going to. And so there's a kind of like a presumption of guilt built into anyone who tries to build on the philosophy. And instead of just waiting for, no, why don't you just wait until you think I've made a major error and then let's discuss it, in a humane, tolerant, and benevolent way without acrimony, without canceling, without banishing, without all that kind of stuff. Does that make sense?
No, it does make total sense. And I mean, this idea that we're open to every flaky idea is just not consistent with what I said at the outset. My original statement was nine out of 10 ideas will be wrong, but the 10th will let the 10th will let in the light. And when I said that, I began, it's like the country tilted and everything loose rolled toward Poughkeepsie, where the center was located back then. And so we didn't publish a ton of stuff because it didn't pass normal philosophical publishing standards. I try to wear my infamy lightly, but, we were as harsh as I think anyone on the more closed venues for philosophy were about demanding quality, demanding reason. And when we had people come on a venture to speak at our summer seminars, we had a really smart audience, like the ones we're gathering around these talks, Clubhouse talks, who, raised objections. And I'm much more confident in that marketplace of ideas and the open discussion and debate.
It's what keeps me coming back.
Yeah. So, anyway, I don't want to take up too much time here because, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of questions. So I'm thank you, Richard and Scott. I'm going to sign off for now. I'll be back when relevant.
Okay,
thanks,
great.
Thanks, David.
Yes, thank you. Roger, thank you for your patience. Do you have a question for Richard?
Yeah, kind of. First of all, I just really appreciate these rooms. So I'm glad that you guys are doing them more frequently and bringing together the scholars from the Atlas Society. I always learn a lot when I come to these rooms. For those of you that know me, I'm definitely a huge fan of Rand and many of the pillars of objectivism are things that I also unapologetically defend. But I've always been hesitant to refer to myself as an objectivist because there is this question of around atheism, and I don't identify myself as a theist. I'm more of a deist, but I've always had this this idea of objectivism as a closed philosophy, and at least in my study of it. And what the Atlas Society has done is allowed for me to think about objectivism in a new way, and to think about how do I apply, you know, the principles that Rand throws out to new world problems, where something comes up where I could scour information and try to ask, okay, well, what does Rand say about this? And to now have scholars that are picking up the ball and moving it forward, I think that's really important. And again, I don't know if I'm ever going to get to the point of being able to call myself an objectivist, just because there is that question around whether or not you can you can believe that there is a creator of the universe and be compatible in this objectivist framework. But I guess my question for Richard would be, what do you say to folks like myself that believe that there's in a rational way we've gotten to this idea that it makes sense that there's a creator, an architect, without believing necessarily in some biblical origin story? How does somebody with that worldview play in the objectivist playground?
I think it's a lot easier for the deist to be in objectivism, obviously, than the theist. And the objectivist view is atheism. But the key here is free will, I think. And if you have deism where God is invoked as a being that starts the universe but then retires and doesn't have any other further active role to play, Ayn Rand said in one of her letters to a minister, I would endorse a religion that really is for free will and sees man as endowed by some creator with reason, because now you're on my terms. Now you've got reason and you have to exercise it. Then the question becomes how you exercise it. But I think in that regard, deism is just putting aside the question of how did this all start? But if you say, having started, we have this thing called man with this faculty, and here's how he should operate, I think that's an easier sandbox to play in, would you say, Roger? So the deists, many of the founders were deists and had this same kind of view. If you don't have God actively involved in your, quote, fate, or anything else, then you're on your own. And that's what Ayn Rand wanted. You're on your own. But by the way, I wanted to say something in case this interests people. When Rand objected to Wallace calling her a Randian, if you think about it, the closed view that says objectivism is only what Rand wrote and said, that's Randianism. I think that is the better description of when mostly critics of objectivism want to dismiss it as just something out of crazy Ayn Rand's idea head. And so they idiosyncratic, you know, a lot of libertarians will call them Randians or Randroids. But when you think about it, the conception that says only what she said and wrote, that is making it more personally her. And she resisted that publicly. She went out of her way to find a word. And apparently this was debated behind the scenes. Should it be existentialism? No, that was already taken. Primacy of existence. So that alone, I think, is interesting to think of closed versus open as the open view is actually her view of objectivism. It's not unique to her. It doesn't die when she dies. But the closed view is, quote unquote, Randian and wrong for that on the conception of how to spread it and how to.
What do you think of the idea that some people like, you know, maybe like a Joel Osteen, their view of God is almost like the law of identity without being explicit about it, but just that thing in the universe that's, you know, the more you give, the more you get type of attitude?
Yeah, again, this is on metaphysics, and I don't think that's really what Ayn Rand thought religion was ruining.
Right.
It wasn't ruining the world because we didn't have a perfect conception of the beginnings. It's that if God is an active element, then you only know that by faith, and then everything falls apart because you're not using your faculty, your one faculty that connects you to reality.
Great.
That's how I would interpret it.
Richard, thank you for waiting. Do you have a question? Richard, are you there? Why don't we go to William while we're waiting for Richard to...
Thank you, Scott. And thank you, Richard, for your presentation. I wanted to ask about the concept of objectivism being a cult, because that's normally how I encounter the smear. They don't really tell me it's a religion. They say, oh, I heard it's a cult. And a cult, in my view, can be something that's not really supernatural, doesn't rely on supernaturalism. It relies more on like a personality who has a strong dictator type style, where he's just saying he knows everything, or he's received revelations from something. So it's more of a cult of personality, and I guess there's some comparison to the way Ayn Rand treated her quote unquote collective, and you hear that often, you know, smearing objectivism as a cult. So I was wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, I agree with you that this is the personality aspect of the smear. But even within religion, and they are reluctant, as you know, calling themselves cults. But in his time, I believe, the Jesus cult, I mean, the cult might have been used to describe even Jesus. It definitely is that part of it. We talked about religions have a prophet, a text, and all that, right? So the analogy they're looking for here is, well, Ayn Rand is this very strong personality. She definitely was. She created this philosophy. She definitely did. She has followers. Followers, notice that it sounds like now you're beginning with a dependence argument. Some people said you can't call yourself an objectivist. You have to call yourself a student of objectivism. That kind of stuff went on for quite a while, right? Suggesting there are tutors and tutored. And you get into all the kinds of things about loyalty oaths. And so, yeah, I think that's where the cult part comes from. I don't believe objectivism ever became a cult, although some people argue that, I don't want to name names, but those in the inner circle tried to make her into a cult figure and then hide behind her and push their agendas. But I also know there are kind of stories about her resisting creating groups to promote objectivism. There are stories of resistance in the beginning to forming NBI. I remember Leonard Peikoff had hesitation about forming the Ayn Rand Institute, precisely because these groups can tend to create, you know, turf battles and hierarchies and authoritative figures and things like that. So I do think the cult aspect of what you're talking about has less to do with the sacredness alleged of the text, but who the personality is.
Great. JP?
Hi. Something that Roger said just now resonated a lot with me, because I come from a very, very similar struggle personally. in the sense that I was born and raised Catholic, and I resigned my religion way before I even knew objectivism, and I delved into a lot of philosophies, including Buddhism, and I was sort of settled into it. And then I learned about the political musings of the Dalai Lama and things like that. And I got disillusioned with organized religion. And then I stumbled into Ayn Rand. And this finally gave me the comfort to call myself an agnostic atheist, much the same as Ayn Rand. And I think I always, it's a running joke that I always pull sometimes when we're discussing these issues with objectivists, that I think that this lady was so smart that she left open she left this cuckoo's egg in very much delimiting the scope of objectivism to earth. To this thing that forms our ethos. And I felt that she was open to anything, any evidence that would change her worldview in a dime. And I think that one of the responsibilities of anyone that calls themselves an objectivist has to be to rely on one's own reason and use objectivism as a stepping point to where your own reason and your own senses will take you. And that's what I want to leave it at. But I think that one would be doing a dishonor to claiming to have chosen objectivism as a life philosophy and not continue to trust new evidence as it becomes available. I can only imagine what Ayn Rand would think of the new psychedelic research that is popping up into and giving very real scientific notions of in the realm of metaphysics. So. It's exciting time, and it's objectivists need to be objective, and that's the only thing, that there's no allegiance to one person, so can't be allegiance.
Thank you, JP.
Great, and Richard, it looks like you're back. I'll give you. All right, then we'll go to Roger. Roger, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. I want to pull a little bit on I like how you talked about the open system. I've always felt uncomfortable when Rand talks about reality, and so and I'm much more comfortable when she's talking about what should we do as individuals. And so I'm wondering if you think it's possible to talk about that sort of philosophy of value or action that she talks about very compellingly, I think, and extract it from the epistemology, or if you think we absolutely need the epistemology in order to get anything out of the rest. I'm curious about what you think of that. You might disagree with me. Yeah, that's totally fine. But I'm wondering if you think it's possible to extract some of those good elements. But I'm calling good elements from what I'm calling bad elements. Can we extract some elements from other elements?
Now, I think I would say, Roger, I think epistemology absolutely fundamental, and the values, if by that you mean the ethical arguments, political arguments that flow from it, absolutely have to be based on an epistemology of reason. So no, she would not, and I don't think we should vacillate on that point. You know, mixing faith with reason, or a little bit of illogic with logic, no. But while we're on the topic of epistemology, by the way, notice she did write something called The Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. The word introduction is interesting. It suggests a beginning. And so even by her own title, the suggestion that that's all that needed to be done on epistemology. She wrote an introduction. Introduction to a book is the beginning of a long book. So, and there are hints throughout that essay where she says the problem of universals in concept can be solved, but so much more has to be done. She even suggests on many occasions in there, more has to be done. So if it's not done by her, I mean, she's certainly not suggesting she's the only one who could work on that because everyone has the capacity for reason.
Does she give you enough to work from? Or at that point, are you just developing your own epistemology? I feel like there's not enough to really work with from.
No. I think the foundational stuff in an introduction to objectivist epistemology is absolutely critical. So if you ground concepts properly, which she did in Percepts, and then go from there to what do we use concepts for, to make sentences and propositions to principles. So no, there's absolutely a solid foundation there, and she made quite an advance. You know, later, Peikoff and Harriman and others did books on induction, and way more on induction than she had done. And, you know, again, for good or ill, it can be criticized, but there's some additional insight there. I'm hearing a theme here. Those coming at it religiously and concerned about the origins of the universe and from a deist perspective, I've always found it helpful to ask someone like that, what difference would it make to her argument for epistemology, ethics, and capitalism if you, were a deist or an atheist? If you can't find a substantial difference in how you come to interpret and or believe, you know, what she's saying in the subsequent branches, then I would really not worry about you. If you think it'd be like a technic earth-shattering difference, namely, oh my gosh, if I go from deism to atheism, I'll lose the whole connection, then that's a problem. Yeah, that's a bigger problem. But I think the origin of the universe thing is way too much is made of it as an issue of whether to accept objectivism or not. I remember I was raised Catholic too, and when I first thought about this, I remember listening to Peikoff, and it seemed completely convincing to me. He said, well, if you need God to start the universe and there's no evidence for that, why not just say it's eternal? That the universe is not in time, namely it needs a starting point and a starter, a prime mover, but it's always existed because that's what's said of God. God always existed. And so he just removes the step that doesn't have any evidence. But both come down to saying eternity. God's always been here. Why can't you say the universe has always been here? So,
David, last quick point with 3 minutes.
Okay, quick point. Responding to Roger's point about ethics, if I have been following correctly, a lot of people who have a religious background actually, and especially in America, live in accordance with what I would call the objectivist ethics. They value production. They use reason in their work. They embrace honesty and integrity as values and so forth. But the big difference, and this is where epistemology comes in, they base that on God's command. As opposed to the objectivist philosophy, which says, no, there's a rational argument based in human nature about why these are virtues. And this is a secular case. It's laid out in a work that Will Thomas and I at the Atlas Society did called The Logical Structure of Objectivism. We outlined what the order of virtues are and why they have the prominence that they do, based on inductive observations about human nature. And it can be done. And if you do it, it is, you're on a fully rational basis, not a religious basis that says, well, you know, yeah, maybe working in high-tech companies and doing my best and using my reason the best I can and being responsible for everything I do. But that's all from God. How about if it were from human nature? That's a secular grounding, the same grounding that high tech has in the first place. So this is why objectivists, to back up what Richard said, this is why objectivists insist on the role of reason and not separating epistemology from ethics. Okay, I'm done.
But Dave, I'm going to turn Richard's thing on his head just a little bit. We can get that, what I'm calling the good stuff, from so many other places, in so many other ways. And so, is it okay to, you know, try to get it from other places if we even feel the need to build that up anyways?
Last moment,
and
Roger.
Then go from there.
Richard, last quick thought.
No, I'll pass on that.
That's fair. Well, again, Richard, everyone, thank you for participating today. This was a great topic. We could do another hour on it. On behalf of the Atlas Society, thanks again to everyone, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you, Scott.
Great job, Scott. Thanks.